This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 74th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm happy to have with me the Uber guru, Bruce Schneier. Hi, Bruce.
Hey there.
Bruce Schneier is British Telecom's Chief Security Technology Officer. He's also the Uber guru of computer security with more media exposure than any number of other experts combined. He's the author of 12 best-selling books, including Applied Cryptography and his latest, Liars and Outliers, published in February 2012. His mailing list, Cryptogram, reaches over 250,000 subscribers. Bruce is also a foodie, a wine connoisseur, a mixologist, and apparently a photographer. He lives in Minneapolis with his wife, Karen Cooper. So thanks for joining us today, Bruce.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You've been in the field of computer security for a long time. What has changed in the decade since 9/11? And are we making any progress?
You know, since 9/11, what's really changed, I think, is the sense of fear and, in some ways, sense of urgency. So we're seeing what the threats that people are worried about are changing. You know, I worry a lot about cybercrime, but what gets the media attention, what gets government attention, what gets government funding are things like cyberterrorism.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of misplaced priorities, you know, I think in our field, that's the biggest effect of 9/11. And a side effect of that is there's a lot of government attention on cyberspace. Whether they're thinking about cyber terrorism or cyber war, we're seeing a lot of, you know, I guess well-intentioned but really bad attempts by government to regulate cyberspace and make it safer.
I totally agree with you on that one. The only saving grace may be that, you know, you can kill three birds with one stone. If we work on cyber war from a defensive perspective, that is building systems that do not suck, then perhaps we'll make progress against cybercrime as well.
Yeah, and that is the good thing about this, that maybe by the attention we'll make things more secure, and that will you know, rise all boats, whatever the threat is.
Uh-oh, sounds like Bushonomics now.
Yeah, but, you know, whether you're a spy or a criminal or a terrorist or a rival government, you know, you're using the same attack vectors, same attack tools, in a lot of cases the same defenses defend against them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my worry is less that aspect and more the types of laws we're seeing passed.
Right. Yep.
Seemingly to protect cyberspace that have the opposite effects. You know, unfortunately, these are technical problems with technical solutions. They're not political problems, and we don't really need political solutions.
Right. So, you know, unfortunately, Howard Schmidt resigned last week, and I think he was a voice of reason in Congress with this latest set of legislation. I'm not sure about the new guy. Do you know?
I don't know. I said Howard's definitely the voice of reason, and he's in a lot of ways someone who's done a great job in protecting us from the excesses of government. It's cyber war is hot. Cyber security against the terrorists is hot. You know, these are our actual fears,
mm-hmm.
and there's an entire security industrial complex trying to get funding, and unfortunately one of the best ways to do it is to stoke fear.
Right. So let's switch gears a little. Your book, Applied Cryptography, sold over 100,000 copies. I don't know what the final number is now. It must be maybe close to 200,000 now.
It's somewhere between the two. It's amazing that it keeps selling.
It's insanely great for a technical book. Just totally ridiculous.
At this point, it's so out of date, but we'll go to the RSA conference, and they'll sell a couple of dozen copies.
Isn't that crazy?
To new people in the industry.
So is writing security books now, like the new one, still a useful exercise?
You know, Applied Cryptography, I used to always say, was a 600-page business card. I mean, the goal of writing that book, you know, in retrospect, was not to make money writing the book, but to become the expert and consultant because of the book.
Right.
And I tell people that whenever they think about writing a book, it's less the sales of the book. Most tech books these days don't sell a lot. they sell a few thousand. But being an industry expert in malware and anti-spam and social engineering, whatever subtopic you write about, you'll do much better after the second consulting engagement.
So this is all true, but the real question, Bruce, is how come you keep on writing books?
I write them because I enjoy writing them, and I'm having things to say. You know, if you think of my career, it's been an endless series of generalizations, from cryptography, applied cryptography, to computer security, to more general security technology, mm-hmm. the economics of security, the philosophy of security. My latest book is really the sociology of security. You know, really an attempt to figure out what's making security work in human society. You know, if I have run out of things to say, I'll stop writing, otherwise you get boring.
Right. So how has press coverage of computer security changed over the last decade, and do you think it's possible to avoid what I call the NASCAR effect?
What is the NASCAR effect?
The NASCAR effect is, you know, people watch NASCAR to watch people crash and burn and sometimes die so they can stick their number on their truck, as opposed to, say, you know, watching the Volvo Car Safety Channel, which doesn't even exist.
I tell you, the attack stories there are the interesting ones. I mean, I think even for us, a good attack story is much more motivating, much more compelling when you tell it, mm-hmm. and even much more interesting to read than a dry recitation of things you should do. So, you know, that's nothing to do with computer security. That's just the way human nature works.
Of course.
I think in the past decade, coverage has gotten more intelligent. And I think that's just a learning process. You know, we had to wait for the police to get more intelligence on cybersecurity and cybercrime, and we had to wait for the press to get more intelligent about it. Mm-hmm. So there's still a lot of hype. There's still a lot of scare stories. But there's a lot of really good press coverage out there of the issues. You know, whether anybody reads it or anybody listens is another issue.
Right. You know, you got to get the hits these days, I suppose. But who do you think's doing the best job?
Wow, you know, I read so many people, I often don't even know where they're from. I think Wired does a great job online. Tech Target is a site I'll go back to again and again to get details of a cybersecurity story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, God, there are others, I just can't think of them.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about economics and security a little bit. It's been around for a while. So what's the latest development? And is security only scratching the surface and picking up the shiny bits from economics and social science? Or is there more to it than that?
You know, I bet there's a lot more to it. This year will mark the 10th anniversary of WICE, the Workshop on Economics and Information Security, which was the first time these disciplines are really put together. And, you know, over the decade, we've been seeing less fluffy papers and more serious papers. I think there's a lot of really good work, both experimentally and theoretically, looking at the economics of computer security. And as more economists see that there's something interesting here, that it's just not just another random market, that we're going to see more interesting research. I'm always amazed by some of the papers, and they're often not the papers I think will amaze me when I look at either the program or if I'm on the committee and read some of the papers and some of the committee reports.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's always great stuff being done.
That's good to hear. So back in episode 9, which was a long time ago in Silver Bullet time, we predicted that insight into economics and security was going to, quote, help vendors produce and sell their products more efficiently. Do you think that's happened?
I think it is somewhat. I'm not convinced it's efficiently in an ethical manner. I mean, we certainly know that economic motivators will entice people to sell products, also psychological motivators. You know, this is getting back to pushing the fear button.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we are seeing more efficient efficiently sold security products. A lot of it is bundling. You know, security is hard to sell because it is not something people want, but something people are trying to avoid.
Or something they expect without really knowing why.
You know, less. I mean, you know, sort of two basic motivators in sales, fear and greed. And greed is easy. I want this thing because I want it. I want what it does. Fear is harder. I don't want the thing, but I want to avoid what would happen if I don't have the thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of a backward secondary sale.
Hmm.
You know, security sells best when it's bundled into a greed sale. So the safety features in your car are not sold separately, but they are advertised features of the cool car you want.
Right. And that's kind of what I mean by, you know, being implicit or whatever, not spoken about. People just assume that their cell phone is secure, even though maybe they shouldn't assume that. And I guess they get upset when they find out that it's not really, because they assume that it was built in.
Which is odd, because, you know, that assumption is because of, you know, government regulation, government intervention that forces vendors to make products safe and secure. And in a sense, when they realize they've been deceived, it's a lost faith in government.
Absolutely.
Now we're living in a world where, you know, government is considered evil, and here they are doing a lot of good. Yeah, I mean, we in our society have a very implicit belief that all our consumer products are safe, are secure, are the food we buy isn't going to poison us, the buildings around us aren't going to collapse, and our cell phone is going to do what we think it does. And when that turns out to be wrong, we are surprised and often angry.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not really sure who to get angry at.
We can just be generally angry and you know, listen to right-wing radio, I suppose.
But that doesn't actually help. You know, anger is best when it's directed somewhere at someplace that can cause change.
Right, right. We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. So we're well into liars and outliers space now. Your new book, which came out in February, it's all about trust in society, and it uses the prisoner's dilemma as an important foil. So can you explain the prisoner's dilemma and then Axelrod's dynamic hack to the prisoner's dilemma, please?
So what I'm looking at in the book is the sort of dynamic between group interest and self-interest. So I'll give you a sort of an easy example. It is in my self-interest to steal stuff, because if I do, I get some cool stuff. But it is in all of our self-interest to live in a society with no theft, because society does better and we all do better. But if you think about it, it's really good for me to A, live in a society with no theft, and B, steal stuff.
Yeah, well, that's the clever thief argument from Hume from a million years ago. Yep.
But if everybody does that, then everybody steals and society collapses. And the prisoner's dilemma catches that dynamic between what's best for me as an individual and what's best for me as a member of society. And what the dilemma shows is that if everybody pursues their self-interest, the system collapses.
Right.
It's a parasitical argument.
If we all defect, then it's a disaster.
Right. Parasites do best if they're not too successful.
Mm-hmm.
The tapeworms in your digestive tract eat too much, you die, and they die. Right? So that's a fundamental dilemma of any society of individual actors, not even intelligent actors. And what I look at, and this is a security spin, how does society induce cooperation?
Mm-hmm.
How do we get people to not steal?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I have four basic mechanisms. I'm going to get to Axelrod in a second. The first one I call morals, which is all the stuff in your head. Right? Most of us don't steal because we know it's wrong, we've been taught it's wrong, we believe it's wrong, we feel guilty if we do. I mean, there are a gazillion sort of different emotions around that make most of us honest most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
The second piece is reputation,
mm-hmm.
and here's where Axelrod comes in. Right? Some of us don't steal because what other people will think. Right? I mean, if a friend comes over and he steals my sweater, I'm not going to call the police. Just won't invite him over again.
Depends on the sweater. Might invite him over more often.
So when Axelrod looked at the prisoner's dilemma mathematically, he found that in situations where the game would be played repeatedly,
yes,
that a computer analog of reputation developed.
Mm-hmm.
And if programs were able to remember past behavior of each other, they could outcompete.
And it was mostly because of, you know, the idea of tit for tat. So that guy screwed me last round, so I'm going to get him this time and get him back.
Right, and tit for tat is kind of a basic human nature. You know, so this morals and reputation is pretty much our primitive evolutionary toolbox. Mm-hmm. This is how we induce cooperation. Right, society grows, gets more complex, gets larger, and we institutionalize this. We have laws.
So is that where trust comes from, you think?
Trust comes from all of this. And then the fourth piece is our physical mechanisms, actual security mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
So I think of my house, right? Most people don't rob me because they know it's wrong. A bunch of other people don't rob me because of what everyone else will think. The few left won't rob me because it's illegal and they'll go to jail. And for those teeny tiny remaining people, I have a door lock.
I like
right?
it.
So what we've been doing in computer security is just one tiny piece of our arsenal to induce trust.
Mm-hmm.
Right? 'Cause our goal here is to make most people trustworthy enough that all of us will believe that we live in a trustful society. We're not reducing crime to zero. Right? We're just making it low enough that for most of us, most of the time, we don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the trust comes in. Lots of great research on difference between high trust and low trust societies, and societies where there's a lot of trust do better. And we use these four things, morals, reputation, institutions, and security technologies, to induce trust.
I like that. I like that a lot. It's very good. So let's talk about societies which are, in theory, built on rational agents in Kant's categorical imperative. I guess that's just the whole idea of reputation, or that's the idea of morals if you're a rational being? What do you think?
Well, it's going to be all of it. And one of the hard parts in writing this book is to put boundaries on the topic, because it's really very big. Now we're getting deep into the philosophy of why people do things. And a lot of it is morals. You know, we, unlike, you know, any other species, have universal morals. I mean, in some ways, we are amazing. I mean, this morning, I went to the grocery store, and I was in a big room full of people, none of whom attacked me. You laugh, but if we were a room full of chimpanzees, that would be impossible. We are the only species that can get away with that.
Right, right. Because we've learned to cooperate.
We have learned that it's in our best interest to put aside our self-interest in favor of the group interest.
So this can get complicated. So now explain the idea of honor among thieves and the notion of defectors.
Well, but you know, nothing I've been saying speaks to the absolute morals of the situation. So thinking about cooperation, a group of thieves is a community, and they cooperate, which means, you know, doing the thieving stuff to other people and not them, dividing the loot equally, not informing on each other to the police. I mean, sort of all of those good criminal behaviors, right, that's expected of you, let's say, if you're a member of an organized crime syndicate.
Uh-huh.
Right? And you know, the honor among thieves is really talking about the defector, right? That phrase is to say there is no honor among thieves. That, in fact, a thief, when push comes to shove, will turn in his fellow thief to save his own skin.
But, in fact, we do have organized crime. So, actually, what happens is there's this kind of crazy fractal pattern that you see even among the thieves and their defectors.
Well, but there is honor among thieves. And we can now go back to these four different mechanisms. Right,
and
to
talk about
see
it,
what's going on. Right, there are the morals. I mean, there's a lot of group cohesion. There's a lot of we have to do right by each other. The organized crime family. I mean, all of those are trying to push your moral buttons to stay cooperative among the thieving community.
Mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
There's reputation. If you have a reputation as a stool pigeon, as an untrustworthy accomplice, you're not going to get, you know, I don't know, the crime jobs.
Right.
They have institutions, right? If you're a stool pigeon, they will shoot you, right?
Mm-hmm. There's
punishment. There's an extra legal system by which they punish bad actors in their community.
Okay,
right?
So,
and they're going to use technologies as well.
Yep. So let's talk about something that we've discussed in the past in Silver Bullet, this mentality of security that you've talked about for many years. And I would like you to relate the mentality of security that you were born with, that I was born with, and to the notion of why rule breaking is important and how that relates into this whole idea of defection and having the system be tweaked from time to time to improve itself.
Yeah, you know, the story I tell is that some years ago, I forget why, my wife got an ant farm in the mail. Uncle Milton's ant farm. And you remember it when you were a kid. It's
two panes
of plastic,
yep.
A little bit of sand, the ants run around. And, you know, it doesn't actually come with ants. It comes with a card, and you fill in your address, and you mail it in, and they mail you a tube of ants. And a normal person looks at that and says, like, wow, I guess I can get a tube of ants. I look at that and say, do you mean I can mail a tube of ants to anybody I want?
Listen, I was planting my garden yesterday, and I have so many ant bites. I totally understand that attack.
But that's a different way of thinking about the world.
Right.
Security people look at systems and don't say, wow, this is how it works, but whoa, that's how it could fail. And you can teach people computers, you can teach them door locks, you could teach them airport security checkpoints. It's very hard to teach that mentality,
mm-hmm.
that way of thinking, that way of looking at the world and saying, you know, if I just did that, the system would fall apart. Or if I poke that in the wrong way, it's going to have this wrong result, and that's beneficial to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that is such a valuable skill, because that's what your attackers are doing.
So I used to think you needed to teach developers and architects how to do that. But then I came to a different conclusion, which is that you can't, just like you said. And so we need some people who can to live with the developers and the architects to do that.
And I think that's right. I mean, this is something I think you're born in. It's a way of looking at the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yoshi Kono teaches a course in this,
yep.
at University of Washington, and he has his students keep a blog. And I love reading it because it's things like, you know, I went to rent a car, and here are all the dozen ways I could have cheated.
Right.
I went in a taxi ride, and here are the attacks.
Right.
It's teaching people to look at normal life in this backwards way. You know, which means the fine line between the white hat and the black hat is whether you choose to do it or not.
Right, right. Not really the mentality at all, but
it's
rather
exact
the
same
action.
Mentality.
Yep.
You know, and that's why teaching things like how to write a virus, how to write malware, how to analyze malware are so important, because the skills are exactly the same whether you're the good guy and the bad guy.
Okay, now we're going to do a super quick segment called Fad or Future that I just thought up. You ready?
All right.
Fad or Future, cloud security.
Future.
Mobile security.
Future.
What's the next flavor of the day to expect?
Wow, if I knew that, I'd be starting a company today.
So there are no fads? Come on.
Well, cloud is definitely not a fad.
All
I mean,
right.
If you sort of think about the history of computing, it's always been a balance between the cost of data transport and the cost of data processing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? In the 60s, computers were very expensive, so it made a lot of sense to put them in a central location, and you'd have terminals. Right? You had, say, a client-server. I'm sorry, you have a timeshare.
Mm-hmm.
The 80s is client-server, because what was expensive was large storage. Right? PCs became a turn on the desktop, then you had a client-server model. Here we are in 2012, the cost of computing has dropped to free. The cost of data transport has dropped to free. The costs that dominate are the ongoing maintenance costs. So it makes a lot of sense to put the computers in central locations where you can amortize all these lifecycle costs Right? And you access your data from wherever.
I sort of buy that, but I also think it's an opportunity to show some ads to some people when they come to your central server.
Yeah, it is, but it's much more than that. And especially to talk to young people today. Mm-hmm. I mean, they actually don't really know or care where their data is. They're used to getting their stuff on the closest screen available.
Yeah, my son is not quite in that same boat because he does all this video production that has very expensive software, which apparently you can't just install in the cloud.
Yeah.
So he's always asking for more computational cycles at home. He wants a better computer. And I say, what about the cloud? And he's sort of stuck with this. The fact that he needs some fancy program to run.
Yeah, you know, fast forward 10 years and he can buy those CPU cycles on Amazon.
Yeah, it should be today, but he can't. So it's an odd thing. So, we're right at the cusp.
Yeah, and I think this is the future. This is the end game. It will never get cheaper than free. The reliability for an average user, the ease of upgrading your infrastructure, I mean, the benefits of the cloud, and it's you know, cloud isn't new. I consider cloud your data on someone else's hard drive, right? And that was the 60s, that was the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and it's now. It's just more and more of it mm-hmm. as it becomes economical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think about the telephone, right? You know, my data is somewhere in the phone switches. I don't care where. I don't care how it magically works. And you talk to young people, they're used to if they lose their cell phone, they get a new one, they push a button, and all their stuff magically reappears. They don't know how. They don't care how.
Yep. All right. One last topic. You've railed correctly, I believe, on the TSA for many years. How far behind is the government when it comes to security?
You know, that's a big question because there's a lot of different pieces to it. I think the government is as far behind as everybody else. I don't think they're doing better or worse when it comes to IT security. I mean, it's all the same networks. It's all the same people doing the work. Now, I think there's a lot of inertia in the institutions of government, but there's a lot of inertia in big corporations as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see much of a difference. I think we're all behind. I mean, in a fast-moving technology, the bad guys have an advantage. Right, they have an advantage because, well, they're the first movers, because they have a shorter development cycle. I mean, they can more quickly make use of technology. And the good guys have to catch up. You know, imagine someone invents a motor car, right? And the police say, wow, we need one. So they have an exploratory committee, and they write an RFP, and they get bids, and they evaluate proposals and buy a car and have a training site mechanism to figure out how to use it. Meanwhile, the criminal says, oh, look, new getaway car. And we saw that in computer security.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the internet appears, commerce appears, and a new breed of cyber criminal turns up immediately. And it takes the police, who are, you know, trained from Agatha Christie novels, a good 7-8 years to catch up to the new criminal techniques.
Mm-hmm. And there you have the important role of the defector right there.
That's right. You know, and that's sort of the surprise ending of my book, that defectors are the vanguards of social change.
Yep.
Breaking the rules is important.
I'm with you. So last question, which has nothing to do with security, but it's going to pit two aspects of your own self against each other. So what would you prefer to have before a nice dinner, a glass of wine or a carefully crafted cocktail?
You know, it's going to depend on the wine and the cocktail, but these days I'm going to say cocktail.
Good man. That's what we wanted to hear. Cocktail. You heard it here first.
Although, honestly, there's a lot better wine you can get if you get enough budget.
Thanks, Bruce.
Thank you.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital, an IEEE Security and Privacy magazine, and syndicated by Search Security. The March-April 2012 issue of IEEE S&P Magazine is a special issue on security training and education. The Silver Bullet interview features our chat with Dacient founder Neil Daswani, whose company was recently acquired by Twitter. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.